Who glued these quarters down?
I did.
What the hell for, man?
I don't feel that I need to explain my art to you, Warren.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of That's So Random, a random movie podcast. I'm Heath Lambert. My movie this episode, from 1995, Empire Records. And if you're happy to see, or hear, I guess, an episode about Empire Records, the man you have to thank is the man who suggested it for Listener Request Month, Dan. I forgot it already. God damn it. Dan Dolan. Dan Dolan. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much.
What is your history, I guess, with Empire Records? I guess I don't know what age of a man you are, but I'm 46. Maybe. This is a movie I for sure, I don't remember if I saw it in theaters or not, but I watched this so many times on VHS. It's not even like I have good chunks of this movie memorized.
Same. I'm 39. My brother showed it to me when I was far too young to understand most of the jokes. And then I watched it again when I was older and could understand it. And then after that, I watched it several times, again and again and again, first on VHS, then on DVD.
Sure. This movie is a real good example of why you shouldn't worry about Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes.
Because the audience score for this is like an 85 or 86 something percent. And the Rotten Tomatoes score is a 31%, which is despicable.
Well, they kind of, I don't know if you know some of the history behind it. They kind of torpedoed it. The studios did. They didn't promote it. They did. They only put it in like a fourth of the theaters they said they were going to originally.
Yeah. And I also saw that it had, it was originally 40 minutes longer and had three other major characters that were completely cut out of the movie, which is baffling to me.
Yeah, it was originally supposed to be over 2 days, and then they edited it down to be all take place in the same day.
But how do you cut around, especially like the dancing on the roof at the end? How do you cut around three whole ass characters who just disappeared from the movie?
Like that part I don't know too much about. The only characters I know that were deleted were not major. There was the sister for Liv Tyler's character and a character played by a young Tobey Maguire, who all I know is he was in it. I have no idea what his character was supposed to do, but all I know is that he was at one point in the film.
Well, hashtag release the Moyle cut, huh?
Yeah.
Directed by Alan Moyle, who also directed Pump Up the Volume. Yeah, I don't know. I love this movie, man. I don't feel like it's, I suppose there's moments here and there that modern audiences would look at as air quotes cringe.
Yeah.
But I don't know, man. This is exactly the kind of movie that right now critics are saying like, oh, you can't even make movies like this anymore. Because it's nothing but blockbusters. It's nothing but MCU movies. Well, you had it right here.
Right.
In 1995 and you hated it. So
yeah. Yeah. I would love to see more movies like this. Just slice of life, no quote-unquote villain, no, like, it's just like characters interacting.
Yeah, killer soundtrack.
Yes.
Very quotable, I feel. I know there's there's a line probably at least once a week in my day-to-day life. I say to someone, I don't feel the need to explain my art to you, Warren.
Like, yes. Yeah.
It's
what is with today today?
Yeah. Superb. Yeah, I don't know. I unabashedly love this movie, and let's talk about it.
Sure.
Well, we start with Lucas, played by Rory Cochrane. He was in Dazed and Confused before this. And that I always feel like he should have, there's a couple people in here I feel like should have had better, bigger careers, and he's one
Me
of
too.
Them. Because then
he ended up in one of those forensic shows, didn't he?
Yeah, he kind of got relegated to CSI Miami for a while, which, look, it's probably a good paycheck. Good for him.
Yeah.
But because he was in Oculus, which is a movie that people, I think, forget rules.
I don't think I've ever seen that one.
It's a Mike Flanagan joint, and it's
that's the one with
amazing.
Karen Gillan, right?
Yep, Karen Gillan, Katie Sackhoff, and Rory Cochrane are kind of the three names in that, and it's really good. But Lucas is closing the record store, name of Empire Records, for the first time. It's a big responsibility.
Right.
And while doing so, he finds a contract in his boss's desk, basically saying, we're selling Empire Records to this big chain music town, and he isn't going to stand for that. So he takes the evening's deposit, which is what, $9,000?
I think it was $9,000, yeah.
Takes it to Atlantic City thinking, here we go. I'm going to win us enough money to save Empire, you know, that we don't have to sell to Music Town and we can remain Empire Records. And it looks like he's doing okay at first, but of course, all it takes is when you stupidly let your winnings ride on, just keep letting it ride sooner or later.
Right.
Yeah, he loses it all. And that's kind of our starting point.
Yeah, and he had this like big Zen moment, and he was he kept repeating, what was it? I wrote it down. The bold and courageous act must change the course of history. And
yeah, and as the door said, the time to hesitate is through.
Yes.
Well, his boss, who runs Empire Record, doesn't own it, but runs it. A fellow named Joe is played by Anthony LaPaglia, who welcomed back to the show in previous episode of mine, So I Married an Axe Murderer, with Debbie Mazar, who's also in this film in Empire Records as well. So this is, for me, a nice little cast reunion. He's great. The whole cast is kind of the only person in the cast who I think I kind of understand why they didn't necessarily blow up is the guy who plays AJ.
Okay.
The
I think he also ended up on CSI, didn't he?
I think a bunch of people ended up in CSI. Yeah. Whitworth or something like that is his last name. He's the only one in here who performance wise, I'm kind of like, he's fine, but he's not. Nah. But there are a lot
of pretty boy to end up with the main girl kind of guy.
But there's a lot of really good performances in this. Yeah. So Lucas comes back to the store in the morning and is met by AJ and Mark, who's played by the great Ethan Embry, who,
yes, I love him.
When he was in this, Can't Hardly Wait, Dutch, when he was really young with Ed O'Neill, and then kind of went away for a little while.
What was it? That Tom Hanks musical one.
That Thing You Do.
That Thing You Do.
Yes. And then, yeah, he kind of went away for a while and then kind of quietly came back doing lots of horror movies. He's great on Grace and Frankie, the Netflix show. And has like a really like cool career again. Like the arc of his career is cool and interesting. And I always like seeing him and stuff. In this, he's just kind of a shrill stoner. So
the stoner guy. And then he's the slightly more layered stoner guy. And then Eddie, the slightly less layered stoner guy, comes in later.
Yeah, he doesn't have too big of a part, but he does provide pop brownies or cookies or whatever, which will, I guess, not really play an important part, but are part of a fun scene. And then we have Gina and Corey, who are Renee Zellweger, and I believe outside of Aerosmith videos, her first appearance in anything, Liv Tyler.
Tyler.
And yeah, like serious, like important actors and actresses came on. I mean, I guess they would be the main two, but
I think those are the main two that blew up after this.
Because Liv Tyler was never going to win an Oscar or anything, but she was in like huge movies and was like a legit movie star. And then Renee Zellweger has gone on and had, you know, did win an Oscar, I believe. Yes.
Probably
for Bridget Jones' Diary, I think, maybe.
Okay. Maybe. Yeah.
Or was at least nominated. So yeah, movies like this can be a good start for people. And they're kind of besties, with kind of simmering under the surface antagonism towards each other that won't come out for a little while, but
a good girl, bad girl dynamic.
Yes. Corey is very, I guess she would be described as like a daddy's girl who's, you know, always trying to be perfect. She's going to go away to Harvard. Like her life seems pretty put together and perfect. And Gina, it seems in a friendly way, gives her shit about that. But as the movie will go on, you see is maybe not so friendly. Like there's a lot of actual like
jealousy
and yeah. At Empire Records, it is Rex Manning Day. Rex Manning, star of the fictional, I think there actually was a show by this name, but this version of it is The Family Way.
Right.
So he was big.
And had like a singing career.
Yeah, in the 60s or 70s was like a teen heartthrob, and he's still going, still putting out albums, still doing but he's here to do a record signing for his new album, which everyone in the store, of course, being young people and punks and, you know, do not care for and think this guy is a joke, but of course have to put on a happy face for the event. He's played by Max Caulfield, who was the main guy in opposite Michelle Pfeiffer in Grease 2.
Okay.
It's kind of the main place people would maybe know him from if you ever saw Grease 2, actually.
I did not.
I didn't know. Well, a lot of people haven't and shouldn't. AJ is secretly in love with Corey.
Yeah.
And they're like best friends. Corey is secretly planning to, before she leaves for college, to get it out of the way, maybe. I don't know. And also because she's always had a crush on him since she was little, going to give her virginity away, if that's, I mean, what a terrible phrase, but that's how she sees it.
Yeah.
To Rex Manning when he's here visiting the store. And then we have, so there's a lot of place setting in the first like half hour, but it's worth it and it all pays off. And they feel like actual, for the most part, they feel like actual human beings.
Yeah.
Not just, you know, so that's good.
Not generic protagonist.
Yes. Then we have Deb, who is played by Robin Tunney, who I feel is the other person who should have been, to my mind, more so than Liv Tyler, maybe even more so than Renee Zellweger, should have been a huge movie star.
I could agree with that. She did actually a lot around this time, but she never did anything later.
Yeah, because she's in The Craft.
Yeah.
Either right after or right, I think right after this.
I think almost immediately after.
I wonder if that's why, because I always thought maybe she might be wearing a wig in The Craft, and I wonder if it's because her head was still shaved from
she
this.
Is. Yeah, she genuinely shaved her head, and she is wearing a wig in The Craft.
She's also in Vertical Limit, another past episode of mine. So welcome back to the show, Robin Tunney. And she was on like, and she was on another one of those procedures. I don't think she did CSI.
She was on that Prison Break.
She was Prison. I was going to say Criminal Minds, but yeah, she was on Prison Break. And yeah, so she's kind of, she's popped up in things here and there. It's not like she disappeared or anything, but she's, yeah, I always felt like, man, I don't see her in movies. Right,
I agree. Yeah.
Because I think she's probably, for me, the best performance in this movie.
I would definitely agree with that, actually. Yeah, now that I'm thinking about it.
And I think she kind of has the emotional heavy lifting. I guess Liv Tyler does. Liv Tyler and Zellweger kind of, but their emotional heavy lifting is kind of just crying and shrieking at each other. Not to be dismissive. But whereas Robin Tunney's a lot more kind of keeping it smoldering under the surface until she can't anymore. And like, I don't know, she's just, she always seems like a coiled spring that's ready to blow up in your face, which is good.
Yes, she has a lot of good emotional scenes, especially later on in the film.
Yeah, but she comes to work and immediately goes to the bathroom and shaves her head in the bath. Why, you couldn't do that before you came to work? But, and we also see that she has some sort of bandage on her wrist.
Yes.
So the signs are clear.
Freaks out about that.
He does. He's kind of demanding that she explain herself to him, and she's like, I don't have to do that, I just want to go to work. Like, which,
yes,
I get it, he's a concerned friend, but yeah, Lucas kind of steps in and was like, she's okay, you know, let her be, knowing that if she wants to talk about it, she will. So I'm kind of torn on, because you should intercede and try to help people that you see are in a place, you know, that's dark or bad, but yeah, don't, you know, you can't force them to until they're ready necessarily. So they both had the right idea. We see a shot that will pay off spectacularly later of AJ just randomly gluing quarters to the floor for no reason.
Yes,
just a thing he does when he's bored, I guess. But it, yeah,
well, all throughout the film, the employees just sit around doing random things. So I just always thought that was funny that there's so many employees at a small record store and they all just sit around just doing random things.
Yeah, there's usually, I don't know what Mark's role is at all,
right?
If there's a fault to this movie, it's that who are all these, not who are the kids, because I think we get a good idea of who the kids are because they're fairly well written and well performed, but what is their role here at this store? Because Lucas is
Mark uses the cash register like once. Other than that, he's dancing around and
he's just running around the store. He's dusting at one point, but like, what is his role? Then Eddie, the other stoner, shows up. What is he doing here? The only people who really seem to work the cash register are Gina and Corey, and Deb at some points. But like, so what does AJ do here? He's going to go up on the roof and fix the sign. He's
been most of the movie fixing the sign. Yeah.
Yeah. But that can't be his role at the store. Like, they're just all, I guess they all, it's kind of Rex Manning Day. They're going to be busy. It's kind of an all, I run a movie theater, so I kind of understand, like,
yeah,
an all hands on deck situation because it's opening weekend of Top Gun or whatever, you know? So I get that. But there's a lot
and again,
of sitting around in the back room.
Yeah, and again, that might be part of the fact that it was originally supposed to be 2 days of work and not 3 days. And not, everybody here for one day work.
That is a very good point. Yeah, there's Deb's boyfriend. What's his name? Yeah, Burko, who's played by a fellow with the unlikely name of Coyote Shivers.
Who is Liv Tyler's stepfather.
Yes, at the time, that's fascinating to me. At the time of the filming of this movie, was married to Liv Tyler's mother, who had previously been, obviously, in some way or some form or other with Steven Tyler. So it's, yeah, a woman who, but she went from Steven Tyler, no offense meant to Coyote Shivers, good luck to him wherever he is, but that's a downgrade.
Right.
I used to sleep with Steven Tyler, and now I sleep with this guy, a fella named Coyote Shivers.
I'm assuming that's not his birthday, but anyways.
Probably not.
Yeah, he kind of just shows up like halfway through the film, and there's like an implication that something happened between him and Deb, because he seems to think the reason she tried to kill herself is because of him, but we never get an explanation on that.
No, and I'm torn on that, because I do genuinely want to know like what happened.
But right, and at the same like time, one scene.
Yeah, it's kind of
like
cool that it doesn't matter what happened. Like,
yeah.
Just know that she's in a place, you know, because their boyfriend and girlfriend, and she makes some reference to whatever it was that happened last night, and him, he's apologizing, and she's like, "But it's not about you, really." But like, what could it? Like, what? I don't know. What could it be? They had some sort of argument or fight, but
something like that.
Over what? Who knows? And it's kind of cool that we don't know, even though I'm very deeply curious about it. I think for the film, it works better that we don't know.
Yeah, again, that goes with the whole slice of life thing. You know, you don't get all the answers. You're just seeing one day out of these people's lives.
Yeah, Eddie, the other stoner, shows up, gives Mark special cookies or brownies or whatever they are. And it'll be a while before we see those again. So Joe obviously comes to work and finds out the deposit never made it to the bank. The money is gone. Or he went
recirculating.
Where's the money, Lucas? Recirculating is a great line. Yeah, and Lucas doesn't try to deny it. He tells Joe, like, I went to Atlantic City I saw the Music Town thing. I was trying to help us out. And Joe drops the bomb on the entire staff that, like, hey, I was putting the money together to stop this buyout and just buy the store from the guy who owns it. This guy, Beck. Mitchell Beck. Yeah, Mitchell Beck, who actually owns the building, owns the store. I was going to buy it outright from him and it would just be mine and ours. But that's not going to happen now, because this joker thought he knew better and lost all that money. So now we're fucked. So everybody congratulate Lucas on screwing us over.
Which Gina does by playing Best Things in Life for Free on the overhead system.
Yeah, another great song in the movie. There's a bit with Blood by AC/DC. Well, yeah, there's just lots of good music in here. And then, and I think Joe is a great character too, because as angry as he is at Lucas, so angry that he banishes Lucas, like, you are going to sit on this sofa until I figure out what we're going to do. Do not move. Which, of course, he just takes the sofa cushion with him wherever he wants to go.
Nice.
Because he's a smart ass. But then Joe has to go and, like, he has a drum set in his office that he has to go pound on to, like, get his aggression out, like, so he doesn't beat this kid's face in. But you can tell that he legitimately cares about everyone that works for him.
Yes.
Like, he loves all these kids. We see it in a scene with...
Yeah, like a father figure thing.
Yeah, we see it in a scene with Deb. We learn that he, like... They don't use the word adopted, but, like, at some point when Lucas was younger, he went into, like...
State custody?
Yeah, foster care or... a special school or someplace.
Yeah, and he said and, Joe takes him out of that. He doesn't really say got fostered or anything, but...
Yeah, he just says took him out of that, which I don't... Again, we don't get specific details of what does that mean, but gave him a job and sort of, you know, so he's...
Come under his wing, at least.
Yeah, but he clearly actually cares about all of these kids, as crazy as they drive him, as much as he doesn't understand them, probably.
Yes.
Because they're a whole generation younger than him, but which I understand. And then we have Warren the shoplifter. This kid, he calls himself Warren Beatty when asked what his name is. We never
learn his real name.
Yeah, we never do learn his real name. That's right. That, which is another fun little thing. But Lucas spies him from the back room, shoving CDs in his pocket, in his big coat in summertime.
This like weird cartoon looking magnet.
Yeah. And, which I love when he's later when he's sitting, it's just one of those little details that you don't know if it was I can't imagine it was scripted, but maybe, where he's sitting on the sofa and he's just sort of rubbing this magnet on his eyeball, like his own eye, and Lucas is looking at him like, what the fuck Lucas are you doing, kid?
Slowly reaches over and takes it.
Yeah. So good.
Yeah.
But yeah, so then Lucas is chasing this kid around the parking lot and the street, and really, yeah, almost knocks him out with like a car door. Like this,
yeah,
a little excessive.
Again, that whole sequence felt very cartoony, but yes.
And winds up, yeah, dragging him in the back room. Hey, everybody, here's the shoplifter. You have a seat here. Joe's going to call the police. Lucas goes through the CDZ box. Like, what did you, look at this. Like, you stole, I'll just rap metal. Whitney Houston. Making fun of his taste. And this, yeah, Warren's just a belligerent, like, young punk.
Right, yeah. And then I think that's when Rex Manning first shows up. Is when they have him in the back room, Warren.
Yeah, they're taking pictures of him with the stuff he stole to give to the police, and that's when Rex Manning and his assistant, Jane, played by Debbie Mazar, show up. And I like that it's not, oh, what a crazy reveal that Rex Manning is a giant asshole. Like, the second you meet him, you're like, well, this guy's a douchebag. Like,
right. He's making fun of how the place looks and everything, and then talking about his haircut constantly. And
yeah, he's a guy who's an egomaniac but doesn't deserve to be, like, you know, his best days are long behind him. Deep inside he secretly knows it, but he has to keep up the front of like, no, I'm the shit still, like, and everybody wants me, I don't need a girdle, and like, but yeah, he's so condescending, and so yeah, he just treats everyone around him like shit and hates everyone because he probably hates himself. So
yes, he hates that he's been reduced to this.
Yes. Another line I quote a lot is when they're like, we're going to take these pictures of these CDs with you. Hold these, you know, hold these for me, Warren. And he's like, why don't you shove them up your ass? And Lucas says, because it would hurt a lot, Warren.
Yes.
Funny. I say that a lot, too.
And then for some reason, Rex Manning gets in the pictures with him.
Yeah, he takes a photo opportunity with Rex Manning. And I love that this kid, everybody in the store is trying to, like, keep their composure and, like, oh yeah, Rex, we love your new album. We're so glad you're here. Everybody loves you. But Warren, of course, doesn't give a shit. And he's like, this guy sucks. This guy's album sucks. All his albums suck. He's like laughing at him and stuff. And
right. And all the kids clearly agree with him. They're trying not to laugh.
Yeah, they have to keep the poker face up. Gina comes out. Gina has found the box of Music Town aprons that they're going to have, that's going to be part of the dress code when Music Town takes over soon, and comes out wearing only that, much true to the delight of Warren, who's right, trying to peek. And Joe is just like, God, go put some clothes on. And everybody's egging her on. And Rex Manning sees her, of course. Like, she's really putting on a display for Rex Manning and everyone else. I mean, she doesn't care that Rex Manning, she's just doing it to do it. Like,
right.
She doesn't really have an agenda. That's just, it's just Gina. Mm. Yeah, I don't feel the need to explain my art to you, Warren, because Warren is in the back room waiting to release. He's trying to pick these quarters up off the floor, and he's like, who glued these quarters down? And AJ says, I did. Says, what the hell for? He says, I don't feel the need to explain my art to you, Warren, which is one of my favorite lines in any movie ever, maybe. It's just so good. We have a scene of Rex Manning signing autographs for one of two kinds of people. Either middle-aged to elderly women who still have a huge crush on him. And one...
That one woman just doing like a weird opera version of that fake song they made up for him. And
yeah. But there's always a sense, there's always... Their interaction is never as good as it should be for him.
Right.
Like the one lady is like...
It's a reminder
that
his time is over.
Yeah. She's like, oh, you were my favorite singer and high school, and it's like a lady in her early 40s or something, and he's like, oh, who's your favorite singer now? still you. You know, he's very annoyed. And there's a teenage girl who's like, oh, you know, sign this. He gets the name, and he's like, that's a lovely name. She's like, oh, it's my mom's, it's for her, I don't know who you are. I've never heard of you. Which is such a what a deep,
devastating, like, thing to say.
Yeah, devastation. And he just has to roll with it because he can't scream at these people in front of. And there's one sort of thing in this movie that maybe hasn't aged super well, it's the comically effeminate gay man in line who's like got the vapors when he sees Rex Manning and is going to pass out.
Right.
But beyond that, like for a movie from 1995, you would think there would be way more problematic stuff in here, and there really, no, there really isn't.
Not that I can really think of. There's like a weird light implication that Corey's father is abusive, but other than that, but
yeah, but nothing. But I mean, I almost expect for a movie like this from this time period, I expect somebody to be dropping the F slur or calling somebody a retard or, you know, stuff like that. And it doesn't have any of that. So that's cool. Jane, who's tired of being verbally abused by this asshole Rex Manning, just quietly quits and doesn't tell Rex at all. She just tells Joe, who she's kind of, I wouldn't say they're making eyes at each other, but they seem to
learning,
be simpatico kind of instantly. And she tells him, like, I'm leaving. I don't know what I'm doing here. This is not the job for me. This sucks. And he's actually just trying to get it all. He's like, no, don't go. Like, but I think it's...
Yeah, not because he likes Rex Manning, just because that's one more thing going wrong in his day.
Right? Exactly, yeah. Now I'm going to have to deal with Rex when he finds out you left.
Right.
And also because he likes her. Like, no, it'd be cool if you hung out here with me the rest of the day, because I know you're like the one ray of sunshine in this shitty day I'm having.
The one adult I'm getting along with.
Yes, the only other adult around other than fucking Rex Manning who I can't stand. And then Mitchell Beck, the owner, arrives and is like, hey, the bank called and said there was no deposit. So, and Joe tells him, like, oh, yeah, I got it here. I didn't have time to get it there or whatever. And Mitchell makes it pretty clear that, like, I don't like this place. I don't want to be here. My father owned this and back when it was like a plumbing fixture store.
I wrote it down. It was Beck's Bath and Bidet.
Yeah, that's what it was. And it used to
actually, it was his
like,
grandfather, and his hippie father turned it into a record store.
Yeah, and if it was up to him, he would turn it back into a bidet store and make real money. And he can't wait to sell this place to Music Town and be done with it. And this guy's not an asshole the way that Rex Manning is an asshole. He's just a corporate suit guy, you know.
Anybody who worked with him has met this person before.
Yeah, he's not full on evil. He's just a square, you know.
Right.
Which makes him the
man. Doesn't actually care about the employees like Joe does. He cares about the money.
Oh, yeah. He couldn't even tell you the employees' names. Like, Lucas is sitting in the back and Lucas is trying to talk to him. He's like, who are you? He's like, I'm Lucas.
Lucas
I work
says
here.
To him like three times, I work here. I work here. I still work here. Yeah.
He's like, great. Okay. I'm talking to Joe. Just cannot be bothered to engage or care about any of them. So the police eventually do show up. Take Warren away in cuffs for juvenile shoplifting, I suppose. And he vows revenge that he'll come back, you know, and he's yelling it. Yeah. And he's yelling because he's heard the whole story from everyone around him talking.
There's
yelling
a scene where the police officer is getting the info of what happened from Lucas, ironically, and saying, oh, Mr. Lucas. He goes, Mr. Lucas stole $900.
Yeah, it's kind of like, why are you arresting me for stealing some CDs? When that guy over there stole $9,000 and nobody's talking about it. Like,
yeah.
Which, I mean, you know, fair point. Observant kid.
Exactly.
Then there's two kind of back-to-back great Deb scenes with Robin Tunney. Burgo, it's the scene we talked about where Burgo, the boyfriend, comes and they have the discussion about, like, it wasn't about you. But he's clearly worried about her and is like, what? Like, this is a new look. You had hair when I saw you last night. So this is, you know, maybe not great.
Yes.
And not to mention whatever's going on under that bandage.
He's very, very tentatively trying to figure out where everything stands.
Yeah. And she's just like, I just need some time. Like, just leave me be. Which he does. Good boyfriend. And then we also get a scene of Joe talking to her where you clearly see that Joe is like, cares and wants to know.
That's one of my favorite scenes.
It's a great performance from both of them. It's a great performance from Deb or from Robert Tunney. Because what does she say? It's something about like, oh, Joe's like, can I call your mom or something? And she says like, oh, if you have her number, that would be great because I would love to talk to her too. Like, yeah. She hasn't seen her mom in who knows how long. She probably doesn't have, she probably has been living on her own as
and
an
then
adult.
Pauses for a second and goes, I know you didn't mean anything by that. After she got like the sarcastic thing out, she stops and says, Matthew said that. I was just being a bit just venting. And I really like that second where she stops and says, oh, I know you didn't mean it. because he was already getting ready to apologize.
Yeah, because even in this moment where she has so much going on and like she doesn't want to hurt Joe's feeling, like she doesn't want Joe to think that she's mad at him. Like they, that's all these people, really care about each other.
Yeah, the other reason I really like that scene is because one, previous to this, she's just been throwing up middle fingers at people, and but here she's being kind of caring and talking to him. And two, previous to this, he's just been screaming at people, and this is one of the first scenes where he kind of just stops and calmly talks to somebody else, and it's just really paints a picture.
It does. It's really good writing.
Yes.
You know, and then for especially for a movie with 31% on Rotten Tomatoes, this is pretty good. Yeah. Then we have, this is rough, Corey's disappointing attempt to seduce Rex Manning, who continues to prove what a shit pig he is.
Yes.
Because he's like...
First, she goes to Joe and that whole... She starts, I'm going to bring his lunch. And then they go back and forth. And all of a sudden, she just screams at the top of her lungs, I'm bringing Rex's lunch.
Yeah, she really wants to bring Rex's lunch, no matter what, who Joe tells her is already... has that job. He's like, okay, that's fine. Jesus, like everyone's crazy today. He's thinking, you know, you can tell on his face that like, I thought Corey was the one stable kid here, and now she's screaming at me about Rex Manning's lunch. I can't win today. Yeah, so she brings Rex is taking a break from the signing, and it's lunchtime. She brings him his lunch and attempts to seduce him, which at first he's kind of oblivious to.
Yes.
Which tells me. And not because he's not someone who's going to mess around with someone so young, because clearly he will in a minute. But I think it's because I think it's been so long since the days of being a heartthrob, the days of women throwing himself at him, that he doesn't even recognize it anymore when it's happening.
Yeah, maybe that's
telling.
Yeah, it did seem like he was like dismissive, and then he went for it in like the worst possible way.
Well, he's not even noticing that like she's like leaning back against the thing and she's got a short skirt on and she's like got her legs very, you know, and he's just talking to her like, blah, 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 I just want to eat my food. Like he's not even registering her as a human being in the room with him.
Yes.
Until, then she like takes her shirt off and she's just standing there in like bra and underwear. And then it finally sinks in. They're like, oh, shit. Okay. This girl. And his response is like, because she... in her mind has put together this elaborate fantasy where before I go off to college, this man I've had a crush on forever, it's going to be this beautiful romantic love making, right?
Yeah. Like a romance novel type of situation.
Yeah. That's what she's picturing for her first time. And he just unzips his fly and is like, go for it. Which is,
and so you may not have seen it, cause I think I watched like the director's cut or whatever. Mm-hmm. So there were scenes in there that I don't think are in the regular version, because I started to watch it again on Hulu just to rewatch it, and it was shorter. But he unzips his fly, and then I don't think this is in the regular version. He starts shaking the salad dressing and say, I hope you like blue cheese.
Whoa, no, that is not in the version that's on Hulu.
Yeah.
Wow. I think I've seen that before because I have the Blu-ray somewhere.
But, yeah.
Or not somewhere. It's behind me on these shelves. I probably haven't watched the Blu-ray in a while. Wow, that's rough. The scene was bad enough without that. So I actually don't mind that they took that out, because like,
because in the version I watched, it has the scene where her sister brings her Harvard acceptance, and I know that's not in the real version.
Oh, definitely not.
Because the sister's one of the three characters they talk about getting cut.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm gonna have to watch the extras on that on my Blu-ray now. So she runs away crying, goes up to the roof to sort of hide away, which is when AJ chooses the absolute worst possible moment to confess his love. And when she doesn't even necessarily turn him down. She's just like, she's going through it. She's in the middle of a lot.
Right.
And he, you know, and it's just like, I can't even talk about this right now. Like this is,
she completely shuts down. She's just, she's not even wanting to listen to what word he's saying.
Yeah. This is not a conversation I can deal with right now. But does confess to him that like, oh, I just threw myself at Rex Manning and got shut down, which he takes pretty badly in a jealousy sort of way. So on top of getting sort of not shot down, but shut down by this girl he's in love with, So everybody, this is coming into the third act, right? The complicated, everybody's at rock bottom, right?
Right.
That's where you have to get. It's screenwriting 101. Even Mark is at rock bottom because he takes these pop brownies and then he's watching. Was this my first exposure to Guar? Probably. I had a roommate probably 3 or 4 years after this movie came out that was a huge Guar fan and tried a number of times to get me into Guar, and I couldn't get into it. But yeah, this might be, he's watching a Guar music video and then he's in the music video because he's tripping balls.
Yeah.
And then he's getting killed by Guar on stage and it's freaking him out, which is a,
and they had to heavily censor the band because their costumes are anatomically correct.
Yeah, which is a thing that I did not notice because I had mostly watched this, like I said, on VHS.
Yeah.
You know, but now in the age of Blu-rays and 4K and enormous TVs, I had never noticed the many, many times I watched this on VHS that, yeah, Odorous Orungus's cuttlefish of Cthulhu thing that he wears, which is just a big, like, phallus hanging off the front of his suit, is, like, blurred out. And
yeah,
I never noticed that until I watched it this time where I was like, oh shit, now that I can actually see in like high definition. Yeah, there it is.
They make the bottom of the screen like repeat over and over and over or something like that. It's very blurred down. And yeah.
Corey has sort of run off and is like hanging out at a cafe, and Gina comes to find her. And then here's where they kind of are at odds now too, because she admits to Gina what she did or what just happened to her. And Gina's like, oh, you know, Miss Perfect's not so perfect after all. And because Corey says, like, but I'm not like you. I'm not like you with guys. Like, implying, like,
Gina tries to admit, like,
slut shaming Gina
immediately,
basically,
set her up to with someone else. Like, and
yeah,
that's when, like, Corey, like, basically kind of shames her for her lifestyle. And,
yeah, because, like, apparently Gina's, yeah, sleeps around or whatever, which. Yeah, Corey just isn't like that. And so they're, so now Gina is offended and makes a bad decision.
Yes.
Either as, I think partially a big part of it is revenge against Corey for saying that to me, but also because Gina appears to have, and I'm not, I know this is such a trope cliche about women who are quote unquote promiscuous, that they have self-esteem, like not necessarily. Some people, God forbid, just like to have sex because sex rules. They don't necessarily have to have daddy issues. They don't necessarily have to have low self-esteem. But Gina appears like she probably does. She's very jealous of Corey and her life. And so she successfully seduces Rex Manning, partially as payback against Corey, partially just because it's a thing she likes to do, because why not? And I think partially also because, yeah, she's kind of been beaten down by Corey and she's got to get herself back up. And this is what she does to make herself feel wanted and appreciated. There's like complex character shit going on in this quote unquote dumb little movie, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And everybody sort of is standing outside the count room while this is going on. And every person who comes through who's asking, where's Gina? And they just keep pointing at the door. And then where's Rex? And they just point at the door.
Yeah. So it was funny that, you know, they could have just cut off the camera at a certain point and implied something, but they showed it full on, but Rex never took his underwear off.
Yeah, because the way she gets him is this whole thing about, like, I can tell you what underwear you're wearing just by looking at you, and I'm never wrong, and she gets it right.
Right, but even while they're doing it, he has it on. So I don't understand what the purpose of that was. They could have just cut the camera off at a certain line if they wanted to keep everybody clothed.
Yeah, I'm assuming that's a
90s thing.
Well, a PG-13 thing and a, yeah,
just seemed
not
a little
wanting
silly to me, but
too explicit with it. But yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, so Gina emerges from the room just as Corey's coming in and is like, I don't feel good. Joe, is it okay if I count out and go home for the day? Hey, where's Rex? And everybody's just like, stare at my shoes. Don't say anything. Because I don't know at this point. I don't think everybody else knows. I don't think AJ's the kind of guy who would have ran around and blabbed to everyone else that Corey threw herself at Rex.
No.
Unless Gina did before.
But I think her crush on him was public knowledge, probably.
Yeah, that was pretty obvious. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. That's true. Yes, and then we have a huge screaming blowout between Gina and Corey, where we find out that Corey's on speed. That's how she's been studying so hard while working a at least part-time job to get into Harvard. She's taking speed so she can stay up all night and study. And
first, Gina breaks down about the speed and about how perfect Corey is, and then she's taken away, and then Corey breaks down.
Yeah, and Corey grabs the scissors and is stabbing the Rex Manning like cardboard standee, like really having it. And then we get another sweet scene of like Deb, who has enough stuff already going on, but I think also obviously can empathize of like, hey man, we all have bad days. I'm having a bad day. I had a bad night last night.
Yeah, she seemed it was very important to her that she was the one that was there for Corey, and because she makes a point of asking Joe for that she be the one to do it. And I think it's because she was happy that it was a situation where she could be the stable one and somebody else could be the messed up one.
That is true. That is an insightful observation that I had not even thought of. But yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, and Corey's like, why are you being so nice? Because Deb and them were always kind of a little antagonistic, because they were like, you know, they're like the cute girls, the Barbie girls, that, you know, and she's the punk rock, you know, sort of pre-emo kid, you know. So she was always kind of making fun of them, and they would kind of rib her back. Like, there's the scene when Joe handed out the Music Town dress code or whatever, and Deb and Gina are at and they're kind of being catty with each other.
They have a lot of good moments like that. Deb and Gina.
Yeah, but then they're like, no more fighting, less fighting, more ripping, and they team up to tear the thing up so they can agree upon one thing at least, which is that Music Town sucks. And that once they all get past their sort of surface issues, both with each other and with themselves, they are really this loving little close-knit family.
Yeah,
found family. They just have to get all that shit out on the table and dealt with so that they can see it.
Yes.
Which is cool. But yeah, Deb's kind of talking Corey through her meltdown and, you know, putting cold water on her face and helping her chill out. And Corey's like, why are you being so nice to me? Like, we're not like friends or anything. And I don't remember what Deb's response is, but
she says, why don't we save our Hallmark moment? And
yeah,
then
even then she's like still too cool for school to like,
right. She's the one to push it too far. Yeah.
We're not friends. I'm just, you know, I don't want to see you in this state either. So AJ, also not taking any of this well, cranks up Rex Manning in the store and is dancing to it as kind of a dig at Corey, which is not a cool thing to do. Yeah,
he tries to make her jealous with Deb.
Yeah, and Deb kind of, at first Deb's like, stop it, get away from me, quit dancing, you're ridiculous. But then it's kind of like, once he takes his shirt off, and they're dancing together, they're like kind of making out. Like it's wild. Like she gets swept up in the moment of it, I think.
That, in her defense, that was before the scene where she comforts Corey, though.
That's true. Yeah, I was a little out of order there.
But yes, that seems out of left fieldish.
I've skipped her on my notes a little bit, because that's when Joe comes downstairs and is like, oh yeah, everybody keep dancing. What a great, Rex has since left. When he got caught banging Gina, he comes out and is like, yeah, what's the big deal? And Joe's like, take your shit and get out of here. And Rex is like, that's fine, where's Jane? And they're like, Jane quit, man. She left a while ago. You're on your own. Find your own way home. Just get out of the store.
And then AJ physically attacks him, I think.
Yeah, because he says something, maybe not directly about Corey, but something alluding to, and AJ jumps on him and punches him, and then he winds up, while everybody's pulling AJ off of Rex Manning, Rex Manning takes that moment to get a sucker punch in, hits AJ, and that's when Joe's like, Joe doesn't hit him back, but Joe grabs his,
that was his like man the final purse, straw. Says, yeah, get out.
Throws it at him and is like, get out, Jane's not here, you know, go. And he's all, why don't you all just fade away? And like, he still thinks he's like hot shit, even though he's like, he should be so embarrassed right now.
Yeah,
this entire day should be embarrassing for him.
And then the whole Corey thing happens.
Yeah, that's when Corey loses it.
And then what's next?
Well, AJ's doing the sexy Rexy dance is when Joe turns the music off and comes down and is like, oh yeah, everybody have a great time, like yuck it up now, because in a couple days we're going to be Music Town and I don't think they like dancing at Music Town. And Lucas is like, Joe, you're a superb manager. And Joe's like, say that again. He says, superb. Say it again. Superb. And Joe loses his mind. He cannot take it anymore. He grabs Lucas. None of them are minors. So this isn't like child abuse.
I don't think they ever officially say what any of their ages are.
Well, if Corey's headed off to Harvard, she's at least 18.
Yeah.
Lucas seems like he's probably, 21, 22. I don't know. But what I'm saying is he's not beating up a child necessarily. It's just someone much younger than him. He drags Lucas into his office and you don't see what happens, but you see him getting slammed up against the Venetian blinds and comes out with a black eye. So Joe has had his fill of Lucas's shenanigans and roughs him up a little bit.
And Lucas takes it extremely well. He's just like, yep, I probably deserve that. And that's fine.
Yeah, he knows he had that coming. And he should probably keep his mouth shut. Yeah, then we have the Deb and Corey scene. Then we have the Guar scene. And then they're putting on Corey because Deb was so nice to her. And is now that her own stuff has kind of calmed down, has time to think about other people and realizes like, oh yeah, Deb's, you know, not having a great time either and was possibly suicidal at some point in the last 24 hours. So they put on what I don't know if it's sweet in the movie, but I don't know if in real life if this would be very helpful in the situation or would make it worse. But they put on a mock funeral for Deb where they make Deb lay down with some candles and everybody says nice things about her and how they're going to miss her. Orko says, I just wish you would stay, which is a sweet thing. And it winds up becoming everyone sort of airing their own stuff. And Deb's like, I thought this was about me.
Right. It's kind of everyone starts airing like everything they've never said, basically. I wish I had done this or I wish I could do this. And Deb's just laying there like, why am I being here?
Like, yeah. And Gina and Corey, because Gina comes back and her and Corey have a little conversation that's like, you know, no, I am like, I have just been jealous of you because your life seems perfect. And it's like, no, my life's not perfect. And like, it's stupid that we are fighting. So they come to terms with each other. Lucas tells the story about Joe helping him when he was younger. That's where that comes out. And then Deb reveals she pulls the bandage off and is like, there's just some kind of, I mean, they look painful, but there's just some like scratches.
She used a lady bick.
Yeah.
And she's like, and she said a pretty pink razor with, and she lists off all these things. And it's just, she says, it took forever to even get through my skin.
Yeah, with little pink flowers and a moisture strip.
Yes.
A lady bick. So, in other words, saying that, like, I was down and either I didn't really want to kill myself, so I did it, I attempted it with a lady bick, which is ridiculous and isn't going to do anything. Or, like, I really did want to hurt myself, but I just did a really bad job of it. And that's kind of funny. Like, you know, either way, like showing to them that, like, I'm not necessarily really in danger right now.
Yeah. She says that she just didn't want to be invisible anymore.
Yeah. So it was very much a cry for attention, which is not to, you know, not to say that that's always what it is. You should listen when people, you know, try to tell you this stuff. But in this particular case, in this fictional film, it was hoping someone will notice and pay attention. So it seems like we've passed through the darkest, you know, everybody's coming out the other side pretty okay. And that's the moment Warren returns
with a gun,
a giant revolver and is shooting the place up.
Yeah. AJ's on the register begging him to let people leave. And he's just shooting.
Yeah, he's not shooting anybody. He doesn't shoot AJ, but he's shooting into the ceiling. Like, the first time he does it, it's kind of an accident, and he kind of scares himself with it, but then he's super, like, thrilled by it.
Yeah. He looked shocked, and then he kind of, the adrenaline, he ran with the adrenaline. Yeah.
Yeah, now he feels the power, I have a power in my hand. This is the power of the gun, you know? That seductive, that is power that has captured the minds of far too many people in this country currently. Yeah, but he's shooting holes in the ceiling. Customers are all ducking down or running out. All the other employees are slowly, they're not running out the back. They're not even calling the police. Their concern is AJ's in trouble. They all slowly start kind of sneaking out into the store and going closer to danger instead of further away.
except for Deb, who does not sneak. She walks directly towards him. Yes.
Well, yeah, because Joe goes first and is like, hey, Warren, what are you doing, man? This isn't the way. Like, and Warren's like, you're going to give, you kept Luke because you're going to give me a job now?
Yeah.
And he's pointing the gun at Joe, and Deb steps in front of him. So maybe Deb actually does have a death wish, or at least has come to grips with the fact
that... Yeah, I just don't think she cares.
Yeah, I might die, and I'm okay with that. I don't necessarily want to die today, but if everyone here, if I died... It would bother me the least, I guess, is her. I don't know.
Maybe not even that. Maybe she's just not even afraid of it. She's just not afraid of it.
Or she has a good enough read on Warren to know that this kid's not actually going to shoot me.
Right.
He's all bravado. Because she steps in front of Joe and is literally walking into the gun and like almost to the point that she's putting her mouth on it. Like,
She lowered it, her head, so her forehead was like resting against the gun at one point.
Which Warren's like, what? You're crazy. You're all crazy.
Which is a weird thing for a person to say when they're holding a gun.
Yeah. But yeah, and then that's when he's like, well, you're going to give me a job here after all this? And Joe's like, and Lucas is like, is that what you want? Is that what this is about? You want a job at a record store? And he's like, maybe. And so the police come to get him again, but AJ makes him a... See, even this, they see something in this kid who has been nothing but a pain in their ass, who has now shot up their store and could have killed one of them, they still see in him something like he's one of us. He's a misfit.
Yes.
To the point that AJ makes him a Empire Records name tag with the name Warren on it to give to him to be like, hey, when you get out of juvie for this crime now, you can, like, maybe you can come get a job here if that's what you want. A bunch of us are leaving to go off to college, so there'll be a spot for you.
Yeah.
Assuming the store is even still here and isn't a music town, but it's the thought that counts. Giving this kid a bone. And then, so yeah, Warren gets taken away again. The staff all comes together. Lucas is like resigned to the fact that, like, okay, it's like the clock has run out. There's no way out of this now. Call Mitchell and tell him what happened. Tell him I stole the money. Don't take the fall for this. And Joe's like, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to. Let you throw
everyone starts giving him money,
and all the staff starts pooling, like, oh, I've got $50, I've got $300 I was saving for this, I just sold a guitar, so here's this. And they wind up with they wind up with $3,000, which is not nearly enough, but he's very touched to the point of like tears. Lucas is of that his friends, despite having every reason to be angry at him, have come together to try to help him out. I feel like this is a problem that I have with, not a problem, trouble that I have with doing episodes on comedies, is most of my other episodes are funnier.
Oh, yeah.
Because I can make jokes about, but especially when it's A, a good movie, and B, already a comedy.
Yeah, it's a movie you can't really.
There's not as much to say because the movie's already, without just repeating the movie's jokes.
Yeah.
You know? So I feel
understandable.
Like a lot of my episodes are funnier than this one, but it's still a good discussion. Then Mark comes up with the idea of like, why don't we have a big blowout like party / fundraiser thing to raise this last $6,000?
Yeah, he runs out and the news reporter covering Warren's hold up
and announces on live television that, like, hey, we're having live music and giveaways and we're selling, they're taking the art down off the walls to sell. Like a big poster, like album cover mural poster things.
Damn the man, save the empire.
Right. And just a donation jar. And then Coyote Shivers is up on the, not the roof, but like the, what would you even call that? It's above the entrance.
Marquee?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, up on the marquee with Gina, who had said during when everyone was doing their sort of confessional that she's always wanted to sing in a band, but no one would take her seriously or let her do it. And so here's her chance. Burko lets her sing, and I don't know if this is a song they've been working off because everyone seems to know
it's a real song.
It is a real song, but I think it's a Coyote Shivers song, correct?
Yeah, I looked it up afterwards, and it's heavily censored for the film. They put in a bunch of new words to replace the dirty words, but yeah,
that makes sense. But she gets her opportunity to perform for an audience, all the people outside of the store who have come down for the party, and is very thrilled and happy with herself. Everybody gets their kind of happy moment. Joe and Jane are kind of, you can tell that they're like, oh, maybe they're going to start dating or something, because they're kind of making eyes at each other and talking. Yeah. And Corey is, or AJ is still up trying to fix the big light up sign, the Empire Records sign on the roof, and Corey comes up and starts pushing him around. I love that she's like pushing him down. Not condoning abuse, but
very aggressive.
Yeah. She basically, like, you chose the worst possible time to tell me something like that. Why? Not only because of what had happened today, but because, like, I'm leaving for Harvard. But she's telling him, like, you're a great artist and you should be going to art school and not worrying about what I'm doing. And I couldn't deal with you saying that you love me because we've always been best friends, but I love you too, but I also hate you. And she's pushing him down. And like,
and he reveals that he's going to art school, which I don't know how he got accepted in a day to this art school that he's going now suddenly going to. And earlier he said he just might like to go someday.
Well, but it was supposed to be the next day, right? Originally. So maybe, yeah. Who knows? But yeah, he reveals that don't worry, I'm not giving up art school for you. I am still going to go to art school. I'm just going to go in Boston so I can be closer to Harvard and closer to you. And they kiss and everybody's great.
Everybody starts dancing, the sign lights by itself.
Well, and Mitch comes in.
Yes.
And
a little bit early, yeah. Mitch comes in.
Joe quits.
And they give him all the money they raised.
Yeah, they pay him back the money that was missing, so Lucas isn't going to be in any trouble. And Joe tells Mitchell, like, look, I quit, but I'm going to just go and start a record store of my own. So here, you figure this out. And everybody leaves and leaves Mitchell there to run the till by himself, which he doesn't even know how to work because he's the owner.
And Warren suddenly appears again.
Warren appears with his name tag as if he is an employee. How he keeps slipping away from police, especially after this encounter of shooting a gun off. But he's a slippery little devil.
Well, they said they couldn't charge him with anything because he was filled it with blanks.
Oh, yeah. They do mention that. Yeah. But it's still terrorism. Which,
I mean, like, you could, I wrote down in my notes that this is definitely, you can definitely tell this is a pre-9/11 movie because, not 9/11, Columbine. Yeah. Because even filling a gun with blanks, it would get you so much, like, more than, they basically just gave him a slap on the wrist.
Yeah, that would be considered terroristic threat or something. But, Mitchell cannot, he already hates this place. He cannot run this place by himself. So he begs Joe, like, look, I will sell you my interest in the store to you. Please just, like, cheap. Just let me off the hook and take this place off my hands. So, yeah, Empire Records is not going to have to become Music Town. Joe's still going to run the place. All the kids get to stay and work there if they want. And it's happy ending for everybody. And they're dancing on the roof. I guess that's it. Other than a post, like kind of a mid-credit scene of Mark and Eddie arguing about their musical taste. That's
right.
That's the movie. That's Empire Records. A real good time.
I wrote down just some of the stuff we already went over, like that Cody Shivers being the stepfather and the 2 days thing. But also there was a deleted scene where Rex Manning comes back and plays with Burke on the roof and they both get arrested, which is why Burke goes not on the roof dancing with everybody else.
Wait a second. Rex Manning comes back.
Yeah, because he wants to actually be a real musician for once. So he and Mirko play on that roof thing. And they both get arrested for causing a public disturbance.
I'm glad they took that out because you know who I don't want to have a redemption arc for? Rex fucking Manning.
Exactly.
Fuck that guy.
Yeah. But that's why Burke wasn't on the roof.
Interesting. Yeah, I got to go back and watch the special features and stuff on my Blu-ray. But yeah, that's Empire Records. Pretty great movie.
Cult movie.
Holds up surprisingly well. I think it's genuinely funny. I don't know. I just love it. I swapped out for just for such an occasion. I hung my Empire Records poster up behind me here. Yeah, it's good. Good stuff.
One of my favorites.
Any other final thoughts on the movie from you, sir?
No. I mean, it should have been a blockbuster, I think, but they screwed it over in pre-production.
Yeah, it sounds like a troubled. Yeah, it's probably one of those ones that was just dumped in the middle of November or something. Like,
yeah.
Never let executives make decisions, I guess.
I agree.
Which is kind of
the whole Mitchell thing. Yeah. I never.
Damn the man, save the Empire Records.
Yeah, exactly.
Someone should have had that feeling when this movie came out. It is that time. Well, ordinarily it would be that time of the episode where I press the magic button to see what, or to find out what next episode's movie chosen completely at random from everything streaming would be, except that it's already been chosen. Next week is the second of two listener requests episodes, and it is my unfortunate duty to inform you all that next episode's movie is Rebel Moon Part 1, Child of Farkas, or whatever the fuck this thing is called. A Child of Fire? Is that what it is? Let me look. On Netflix. Rebel Moon Part 1, A Child of Fire, from last year, 2023, on Netflix exclusively. A Zack Snyder joint. Talking about Zack Snyder is something I have managed to avoid for 144 episodes, and I had hoped to avoid for another 144, but next week it all goes down, and I'm preparing my mentions for their terrible demise. But actually, no, you know what? I think people will find when they actually listen to it that I'm pretty even-handed when it comes to Zack Snyder. There's really only having not watched Rebel Moon yet, or Army of the Dead, are the two I haven't seen. But having seen all the rest of Zack Snyder's movies, there's really only two of them that I hate. Some of them I really like a lot. Unfortunately for me, the two that I hate are the two that Snyder cultists love the most. So
yeah,
that's going to be a problem for me when they find it. So, oh well, I'll bite the bullet. But good I luck. Think it'll be a pretty even-handed, because I was a Snyder defender even for a number of years up until Batman v Superman came out, and that's when he lost me for good. But I'll get into all that next episode. We don't need to talk about that here. Don't drag you through the mud. Where can people find yourself on social media and places if they would like to?
Dan D Does on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Threads. Take a look, and you can see my journey writing my first novel.
Excellent, excellent. And thank you very much for suggesting Wandering my way and suggesting such a great movie for me to revisit and thank talk you. About.
Thank you. Hopefully it wasn't pleasure. Too bad for my first podcast appearance.
No, if anything, I feel bad because I tend to, even though I know how to edit things and I can cut it out, I hate dead air so much that I just talk and talk and talk and talk, and I feel like I steamroll over people, and I'm trying really hard not to do that. So I worry no, that you didn't get to say nearly enough because I wouldn't shut the fuck up. So hopefully no. You don't no, feel that
not
way.
At all.
Okay, good.
No.
Yeah, maybe we will do it again sometime. I enjoyed this. Okay. This was a fun talk. I am at HeathLambert78 on Twitter. The show is at That's a Random P2. The show is on TikTok and Slasher under some form or other of That's a Random Pod or That's a Random Podcast. Artwork for the show is by Joe Humphrey, who is Mr. Joe Humphrey on Twitter and Slasher. And the show has an email address, which I'm sure after next episode will be chock full of fascinating reading, at That's a Random, no, That's a Random Pod at gmail.com. And I think that's it. Everybody's homework for next episode. My apologies in advance. Rebel Moon Part 1 on Netflix. Check it out or not. Just listen to the episode, whatever. I know that the guest that I have on for that hates Zack Snyder in a way that I don't. So we'll see. It's probably going to be a lot of vitriol, but I don't, this good week luck. I got to talk about Empire Records, and that feels pretty good. Yeah, I think that'll do it for this episode. On behalf of Dan and myself, thanks for listening, and see you next week. Bye-bye.